Welcome to the June Dermalogic Surgery Digest podcast and Beyond the Digest supplemental podcast. I am the podcast editor, Naomi Lawrence. In this month's journal, we have a prospective split body trial on the treatment of stria distensae showing fractional laser with PRP as superior to fractional laser alone. There is also a split body prospective trial to assess the efficacy and safety of 5-fluorouracil delivered using a tattoo device to repigment idiopathic guttate hypomelanotic lesions. In Beyond the Digest, we summarize a retrospective review from the May JAD, which compares treatment with functional surgery instead of amputation for minimally invasive melanoma of the digit. There is also a dual institution cohort from Cleveland Clinic and Brigham Women's Hospital on aggressive cutaneous squamous cell carcinoma showing the average time to cutaneous squamous cell carcinoma recurrence or death occurs in the first year post-diagnosis, with more than 95% of the poor outcomes occurring in the first 3 years. Finally, I want to congratulate all of the graduating residents and fellows listening to the podcast this month. I wish you the best in your future endeavors. Thank you for listening and have a happy surgery day.
This segment of the episode features surgical oncology and reconstructive article reviews.
This is Erica Levitt reviewing the original article, Mohs Surgeons Dominate Cutaneous Reconstructions in Cosmetically and Functionally Sensitive Sites by authors Andrea Tan and Jordan Slutsky. The purpose of this paper was to use Medicare claims data to quantify the proportion of cutaneous reconstructions in cosmetically and functionally sensitive sites performed by Mohs surgeons compared to other specialists. Data was obtained for CPT codes for linear repairs, flaps, and grafts in the applicable sites, and the specialty for each physician was collected. Mohs surgeons were differentiated from non-Mohs dermatologists by comparing provider NPIs with a list of Mohs surgeons who had billed the Mohs code 17311. In 2019, Mohs surgeons performed 75% of reconstructions in cosmetically sensitive sites, compared to 10% by non-Mohs dermatologists, 8% by plastic surgeons, 2.9% by otolaryngologists, and 1.6% by ophthalmologists. This 75% performed by Mohs surgeons was a statistically significant increase from 2013, when 67.7% of repairs were performed by Mohs surgeons. Complex repairs were the most commonly performed reconstruction type by Mohs surgeons, followed by adjacent tissue transfers, intermediate repairs, and full-thickness skin grafts. Mohs surgeons performed more of all repairs in 2019 compared to any other specialty, except for interpolation flaps, where Mohs surgeons performed 23% compared to plastic surgery performing 33% and ophthalmology performing 25%. Mohs surgeons did perform the majority of non-interpolated flaps, performing 68%, compared to the next highest specialty plastic surgery performing only 15%. And Mohs surgeons also performed 77% of full-thickness skin grafts, compared to the next highest specialty at 11%. Mohs surgeons also performed 15 times more complex repairs compared to the next highest specialty. This study highlights that Mohs surgeons perform far more cutaneous reconstruction in cosmetically sensitive areas compared to any other specialty, with a significant increase among the Medicare population from 2013 to 2019. This information is important because, as the authors mentioned, Mohs surgeons may still not have the reputation among the general population or among other medical specialties as being experts in complex facial reconstruction. This paper shows that Mohs surgeons are the leaders in facial reconstruction in terms of volume, and this information can be used to educate the public and medical community.
This is Michael Renzi reviewing the original investigation efficacy and safety of photodynamic therapy for the treatment of actinic keratoses, a meta-analysis update of randomized controlled trials by first author Chen-Jun Hu and senior author Yuming Sun. Actinic keratoses are a common problem within dermatology, posing a significant cost burden to the healthcare system each year. The authors of this article performed a meta-analysis to evaluate the most effective method for treating actinic keratoses. Cochrane, Embase, and PubMed databases were searched using mesh terms solar keratosis, actinic keratosis, photodynamic therapy, and photochemotherapy for all relevant literature up to July 31st, 2022. Inclusion criteria were as follows: only English language articles, only clinical randomized controlled trials, photodynamic therapy alone must be one of the treatment groups, race, age, lesion, position, treatments for comparison were permitted, and then reporting one or more outcomes regarding the efficacy, cosmetic results, local reactions, and adverse effects. So 29 studies met inclusion criteria and quality analysis. This research included 3,850 participants with 24,747 lesions. Therapies compared with photodynamic therapy included placebo, cryotherapy, and topical treatments such as imiquimod, as well as Picado. Complete response, recurrence, and overall preference were chosen as the main outcome measures for efficacy. Photodynamic therapy showed marginally higher lesion complete response than other methods with a relative risk of 1.87. Only three studies were used to evaluate recurrence. Meta-analysis showed no statistically significant difference with regard to recurrence. 11 trials were used to assess cosmetic results. Among the included studies, meta-analysis revealed that patients with an excellent level of cosmetic outcome were higher in the PDT group. 5 trials were included to evaluate patient satisfaction, and they found that satisfaction of the PDT group was higher than that of controls. Local reactions were ranked as mild, moderate, or severe, and the analysis showed the local reactions of the PDT group were more serious, with a higher rate of moderate and severe local reactions compared to controls. With regard to adverse events, those in the PDT group were more than those of the control groups, but this difference was not significant. Overall, I felt the results of this study were somewhat surprising and had rather limited generalizability, given the fact that they did not find any studies that compared 5-fluorouracil to photodynamic therapy. They only included studies comparing imiquimod and Picado. This is an issue. 5-FU has been shown to be the most effective topical therapy for actinic keratoses, so the lack of studies involved assessing the efficacy of that treatment is problematic. I was also surprised to see that there was a patient preference for photodynamic therapy. My patients certainly prefer the ease of treatments such as medium depth chemical peels for widespread actinic damage or topicals that they can apply at home. So I would be interested to see more research on this topic.
This is Erica Levitt reviewing The Reconstructive Conundrum, Repair of an Inferior Ear Defect by authors Kevin Shi and Rajiv Nijuan. The defect was a 2 by 1.7 centimeter defect involving the cartilage of the antihelix and tragus, as well as the upper lobule. Options considered included second intention healing, but there is a risk of prolonged wound healing with exposed cartilage, skin grafting, but there's a risk of graft failure or poor matching, or wedge repair, which would have shrunk the ear. The authors chose to utilize a tunneled transposition flap from the post-auricular neck as the donor site. This donor site was chosen because it had less background actinic damage and was hairless. All the authors noted that they have used the preauricular cheek as a donor site as well for this flap. I refer listeners to the excellent description in the main text and the supplemental figures for detailed information on flap execution, but one important point is that the pedicle was partially de-epithelialized to match the length of the tunnel. Overall, this is an interesting single-stage repair to consider for inferior ear defects that are too large or complex for simpler options, such as second intention healing or skin graft.
This is Michael Renzi reviewing The Reconstructive Conundrum, Reconstruction of Nasal Alar and Tip Defect by first author Heenan Oh and senior author Leo Kim. The authors present their reconstruction of a 2.5 by 2 centimeter defect down to the perichondrium on the left nasal tip and ala following 2 stages of Mohs surgery for a recurrent basal cell carcinoma. Options for reconstruction of the defect included a paramedian forehead flap and ipsilateral interpolated velolabial flap. The patient requested to avoid a scar on the ipsilateral cheek due to pre-existing left-sided sensory neuralgia from a previous surgery. Thus, the authors performed a contralateral interpolated velolabial flap, reconstructing the left nasal defect with the right cheek. When performing the procedure, care was taken to ensure that there was a robust subcutaneous pedicle to allow abundant vascular supply from perforating branches of the facial and angular arteries through the levator labi superioris, given that the flap was relatively long and narrow. Takedown was performed at 3 weeks. Outcome at 3 months post-op can be seen in Figure 3 of the article.
This is Deirdre Connolly reviewing the communication Management of Scalp Squamous Cell Carcinoma Involving Bone, a survey of the American College of Mohs Surgery. First author, Shoshana Blumenthal, senior author, Rajiv Nijawan. The AJCC staging classification system for cutaneous carcinoma of the head and neck considers bone involvement in the staging of T3 and T4 tumors. However, there is no consensus on what constitutes bony invasion. To further explore this, a 15-question survey was distributed to all members of the ACMS. 136 Mohs surgeons completed the survey, 72% of which were in a non-academic setting. The most common features reported by Mohs surgeons to assess likelihood of cutaneous squamous cell invasion of the calvarium were direct visualization of pitting and other bone irregularities, adherence to the underlying bone on attempted elevation of the periosteum, destruction of the bone on CT scan, stippling of the bone on imaging, and deep galial invasion abutting the periosteum. The article addresses two real-life scenarios. In the first, you're performing Mohs on the scalp squamous cell carcinoma, and frozen section shows squamous cell carcinoma nearing or into the periosteum. A subsequent stage is clear, however, it is incomplete. There's no gross involvement of calvarium. What are your next steps? In this scenario, 57% would refer for superficial cranioplasty and 16% for outer table resection. Of note, 40% would send for adjuvant radiotherapy. In the next scenario, you're performing Mohs on a scalp squamous cell carcinoma with periosteal involvement and a positive deep margin. You're unable to take a subsequent Mohs stage as you're essentially at the bone. There's no gross involvement of calvarium. What are your next steps? In this scenario, 52% would refer for superficial cranioplasty and 53% for outer table resection. Of note, 36% would also send for adjuvant radiotherapy. Most respondents, or 76%, never burr or remove the bone themselves. And I think this communication nicely highlights the next steps taken by colleagues in these real-life scenarios. This is Deirdre Connolly reviewing the communication Mohs surgery on the complex contours of the ear optimized with coordinated subdivision to isolate sections with single curves. First author Lauren Fain, senior author Brian Carroll. In this communication, authors highlight a complex Mohs case involving the left preauricular cheek and left ear and discuss techniques for optimizing the processing of the tissue. A 92-year-old man presented with a 5x2 cm basal cell carcinoma of the left ear. The Mohs excision involved complex contours of the ascending helix, helical crus, tragus, and preauricular area. The specimen contained full thickness contours with the epidermis overlying both surfaces of cartilage. A 10 blade was used because smaller blades can fragment cartilage and impede subsequent grossing. Authors used the techniques of subdividing at inflection points, positioning curved margins, and applying pressure for soft tissue retraction to facilitate representing the true margin. Contours that folded into U shapes were bisected to isolate single curves for final grossing. As such, the pieces containing the ascending helix and helical crus were bisected. Also, during embedding, pressure was applied to pieces containing cartilage to minimize incorporating artifacts and air bubbles that arise due to soft tissue retraction. The trade-off of not performing these steps is increased risk of false positive margins due to improperly positioned epidermis, recuts required for missing epidermis, or poorly represented deep tissue elements. In addition, avoiding bisection forces compromises in embedding, which can impede accurate translation of what is seen histologically to the anatomical location on the patient.
This is Christy Regula reviewing How We Do It, Double Opposing Z-plasties for Pincer Nail Deformity of the Finger, by first author Stephanie Lin and senior author Zhengquan Zhang. Pincer nail deformity is characterized by excessive transverse curvature of the distal nail plate. The distal nail bed has a narrower transverse dimension than the nail matrix. The wider matrix produces a nail plate that buckles dorsally because it is forced to accommodate the narrower distal nail bed. The excessive curvature of the distal nail plate exerts pressure on the lateral nail folds and may cause pain, inflammation, secondary infections, and cosmetic and functional impairment. This communication describes surgical correction using double opposing Z-plasties of the hyponychium to uncurl the distal nail bed and restore its normal transverse dimension, allowing the nail plate to grow without a pincer deformity. Opposing Z-plasties with ankle limb length and 60-degree limb angle are designed on the distal fingertip, 2 millimeters below the hyponychium, so as to not disturb the nail bed. When transposed, they will lengthen the width of the distal nail bed. Please refer to the diagrams in the article for exact placement of these Z-plasties. It is important to avulse the nail prior to performing the Z-plasties and free the fibrous connections anchoring the lateral nail folds to allow for free movement. This article reports 9 repairs done in this fashion with 1 recurrence. This is Christy Regula reviewing the communication using of a foam earplug, a nose surgery pearl by first author Quentin Semeron and senior author Bernadette Akinoff. A nasal trumpet orthosis is commonly used after nasal surgery to prevent the collapse of the nasal valve and provide hemostatic back pressure. This communication details the use of a foam earplug to serve as intranasal support. The earplug is first coated with antibiotic ointment or petrolatum. It is then compressed to fit the shape of the patient's nostril. It is placed inside the nostril where it will expand and then secured with medical tape. The patient may replace the earplug on their own if it falls out or can replace it daily if there is excessive drainage. It also cannot be inhaled due to its size. And this provides a practical alternative for intranasal packing.
This is Dr. Ashley Decker reviewing the communication buried cartilage grafts to prevent contraction and preserve normal anatomical shape in reconstruction of surgical defects of the anterior pinna by Dr. Salmon and Mortimer. In this communication, the authors present a case of a 4.5 by 2.4 centimeter defect involving the entire concha and portion of the antihelix, including cartilage. The posterior skin remained intact. Options for repair include second intention healing or skin graft, but contraction can lead to collapse and deformity of the ear. Cartilage graft with immediate placement of full thickness skin graft have a high chance of necrosis as the cartilage graft is avascular. Interpolation flaps can be considered, however, these are often thick and may require several revisions. In this case, the authors report a novel technique involving a cartilage graft placed within a partial thickness channel formed by the anterior surface of the posterior skin with pockets formed medially and laterally. In this case, a cartilage graft was harvested from the contralateral antihelix. With blunt dissection, the tips of the scissors are pushed into the pinna remnant laterally and medially between the posterior skin and the residual cartilage. The anterior surface of the posterior skin is then incised in partial thickness from the medial to lateral pocket. The incision is then undermined out superiorly and inferiorly while being extremely careful not to disturb the posterior surface of the defect. The incision is incised less than 1 millimeter in thickness. The graft is then pushed into the dissected channel and the edges of the channel are sutured over the graft. I invite listeners to read the article for a more detailed description of the procedure. I think this is certainly an interesting option for a single stage repair. I have also had luck with delayed full thickness skin grafts placed over a cartilage graft. I find delaying placement of the full thickness skin graft allows for granulation tissue formation and increases the chance of the survival of the skin graft. However, this is a two-stage repair and so might not be a great option for some patients.
This is Deirdre Connolly reviewing the communication commentary on how we do it, interphalangeal joint disarticulation of the digit. First author Helen Malone, senior author Nada Berry. Authors read the article, How We Do It, Interphalangeal Joint Disarticulation of the Digit by Drs. Naxted and Beal, and the commentary here highlights the potential issues that arise with avulsing the flexor digitorum profundus, or FDP, tendon, and allowing it to retract. They explain that this may put patients at risk for lumbrical plus finger and the quadriga effect. In the setting of a DIP joint amputation, the lumbrical plus phenomenon occurs if the FDP tendon is not secured. The tendon retracts proximally and can catch the lumbrical muscle. Finger flexion results in paradoxical extension of the interphalangeal joint due to the lumbrical muscle activation from the unsecured FDP tendon. Increased MCP joint flexion may be an additional consequence seen as well. The quadriga effect involves reduced flexion in a non-injured finger caused by a shortened, stiff, or adherent FDP in an adjacent injured finger. The four FDP tendons of the hand are interconnected, so imbalance in tendon length creates restricted movement in the remaining tendons. In the setting of a DIP joint amputation, if the FDP tendon is allowed to retract, adhesions can change the effective FDP length and create a quadriga-type flexion restriction in the remaining three FDP tendons. Prevention of both the lumbrical plus and the quadriga effect is accomplished during DIP amputation by either preserving the FDP insertion on the proximal aspect of the distal phalanx or securing the FDP tendon to the volar plate. The FDP tendon is attached to the volar plate with an absorbable or non-absorbable suture before avulsion of the FDP insertion on the distal phalanx to maintain the native tendon length. After amputation of the DIP joint, a figure of eight suture is placed to further secure the FDP tendon to the volar plate. Authors assert that for most oncologic amputations at the DIP joint, the FDP insertion can be preserved, and in so doing, these complications can be avoided.
This segment of the episode features general dermatologic surgery and cosmetic article reviews.
This is Isabella Jones reviewing combined fractional CO2 laser with intradermal platelet-rich plasma versus fractional CO2 laser alone in the treatment of striae distensa by Syed and Aboutaleb. 30 women ages 16 to 27 with striae were enrolled in the study. All patients had skin types 3 and 4. 56% of patients had striae alba and the rest striae rubra. In each patient, pairs of striae on both sides of the midline with similar location and shape were allocated to receive fractional CO2 with PRP versus fractional CO2 alone. Patients received 4 sessions of treatment 4 weeks apart. The authors further described their laser settings and method of PRP preparation in the study. Patients were evaluated before each session and 3 months after the last session by 2 blinded dermatologists using photographs. Additionally, skin biopsies were taken from the lesions before and after the last treatment for histopathologic evaluation. The article includes a table with baseline characteristics highlighting weight gain and steroid use as the most common reasons for striae. Overall, both striae rubra and alba showed significantly higher improvement when treated with both CO2 and PRP, with the difference being about 40% response rate in the combination group versus 10% in the CO2-only group. When looking at the types of striae, there were no differences in response rates between striae rubra and alba. Post-inflammatory hyperpigmentation occurred in 33% of the combination group, which was lower than the 46% for the laser alone group, but this was not statistically significant. Histopathologic evaluation showed that the combination side was also associated with a more significant dermal deposition of collagen and elastic fibers. The authors conclude that combined fractional CO2 laser with PRP was more effective than fractional CO2 laser alone for the treatment of striae.
This is Monica Bowen, and I'll be reviewing a retrospective review of the laser removal of facial cosmetic tattoos by first author Nina Hartman and last author Monica Bowen. So this is a paper I wrote with my co-authors because in clinic we noticed that there's been an increasing demand for removal of cosmetic tattoos on the face, particularly the eyebrows, perhaps due to the increase in popularity of microblading.
Picosecond lasers are the mainstay of treatment, but there was not a lot of literature on the topic. So we performed a retrospective review from 2015 to 2022 to analyze the efficacy and safety of cosmetic tattoo removal in our clinic. We included patients that had before and after photos of treatment. For black and brown tattoos, the PicoWay 1064 nanometer laser was used with settings from 1.2 to 12.5 joules per centimeter square and a 2 to 4 millimeter spot size. And for the red, pink, and yellow tattoos, a 532 nanometer PicoWay was used with fluences from 0.6 to 3 joules per centimeter squared. Sometimes we use a fractionated CO2 laser after the picosecond lasers to prevent blistering and enhance removal of pigment. A total of 33 patients were included in the review. The majority of the tattoos were indeed eyebrow tattoos, and most patients underwent an average of 3 treatment sessions. Interestingly, in 21% of patients who had brown or black tattoos who were treated with a 1064 nanometer picosecond laser, the tattoo unmasked an orange color after treatment. Thus, this orange color was subsequently treated with a 532 nanometer laser on the same visit or subsequent visit with good clearance of the pigment. No adverse events were reported. In summary, in our review, all the 33 patients had excellent or good responses after an average of 3 treatment sessions, thus faster than standard tattoos that can take up to 7 treatments. One important takeaway is that is also underreported is that black and brown tattoos treated with a 1064 nanometer laser can unmask an orange color after laser treatment. This orange color can be very distressing for patients. Luckily, it is safe to treat on the same day or if you want in subsequent visits with a 532 nanometer picosecond laser to subsequently remove the orange color. With cosmetic tattoos, we do advise to do a test spot for paradoxical darkening or other adverse events if you're unsure of what is in the pigment.
I am Curran Lal, and I am presenting prospective evaluation of the safety and efficacy of thermomechanical fractional injury for perioleritids by Wang et al. This was a prospective clinical trial that evaluated the safety and efficacy of a thermomechanical fractional injury device called Tixel 2 for the treatment of perioleritids. Perioleritids are very satisfying to treat with typical treatments including neuromodulators, HA fillers, biostimulators, ablative and non-ablative resurfacing. Resurfacing is considered the gold standard treatment, but is complicated by intraoperative pain and prolonged downtime. A novel non-ablative thermomechanical device called Tixel causes direct heat transfer to tissues, causing dermal coagulation without prolonged downtime. The way it works is heat is delivered to the tissue via a grid of blunt pyramidal titanium tips that make contact with the skin. The ceramic base of the grid is heated to 400 degrees Celsius, which provides the heat to the pyramidal tips. A distance guide is attached to the handpiece. Upon placing the handpiece on the patient and pulsing, the tips are moved towards the skin. The amount of thermal injury delivered is determined by the contact duration of the tip and protrusion distance of the tip. In this trial, 23 patients, Fitzpatrick skin types 1 to 4, were treated with a mean age of 62.5 years. Each subject received 4 treatments to the perioral area every 28 days. No topical or local anesthesia was applied. At physician investigator discretion, the device was allowed to be set to 6 to 12 milliseconds pulse duration and 500 to 800 micrometer protrusion depth using 2 passes. Perioleritids were graded using the Fitzpatrick wrinkle classification system at baseline and at follow-up visits. Follow-up was done at 1 and 3 months. At baseline, patients had a mean score of 6.9. At 1 month follow-up, the mean score decreased to 5.3, and at 3 months further went down to 5. All subjects had clinical improvement in their Fitzpatrick wrinkle score at both follow-up visits, and no subject worsened. For patient-reported pain during the treatment, the mean score on a scale of 0 to 10, 10 being the worst pain, was 3.1 for all treatments combined. At 3 month follow-up, 74% of patients were satisfied with their clinical results, and 91.3% were satisfied with their treatment experience. There were no serious adverse events. You can see in figure 1 there's improvement with reduction in marionette lines, improvement in the nasolabial fold, and the upper oral perioral wrinkles. This study demonstrates that a thermomechanical fractional injury device can safely and effectively improve the clinical appearance of perioleritids after a series of treatments. Limitations of the study include a lack of multiple different skin types, and follow-up is 6 to 9 months, because you probably would see more collagen production at that time period and more improvement.
This is Megan McLean reviewing the original investigation, fractional CO2 laser versus fractional CO2 laser plus betamethasone calcipotriol ointment in the treatment of nail psoriasis by Dinah L. Sharkawy et al. Psoriasis is a common inflammatory skin condition, and nail psoriasis occurs in more than 50% of patients with psoriasis. It may present as pitting, onycholysis, subungual hyperkeratosis, oil spots, and splinter hemorrhages. Nail psoriasis is often refractory to treatment, and currently, topical or interlesional corticosteroids and vitamin D analogs are considered first-line therapy. More recently, the delivery of these medications through holes made by fractional CO2 laser has gained attention for nail psoriasis. This study sought to compare treatment response to fractional laser alone versus fractional laser with betamethasone calcipotriol ointment. The study took place at Cairo University as a randomized controlled clinical trial. 30 patients with at least 2 affected nails were enrolled. The 2 most affected nails were selected for treatment, one in the monotherapy group and one in the combination group. All nails received 6 sessions of fractional CO2 laser at 4-week intervals. Nails in the combination group also received betamethasone calcipotriol ointment immediately after laser treatments and once daily. Photos from day 0 and 3 months following the last treatment session were taken. Nails were rated with the 8-point Target Nail Psoriasis Severity Index, or the TNAPSI, which essentially splits the parts of the nail into quadrants and assigns a score of 0 or 1 depending on if features of nail psoriasis are present in that quadrant. A low score of 0 indicates no features of nail psoriasis, while a high score of 8 would suggest nail psoriasis findings in all quadrants of the nail bed and matrix. All patients completed the study. The pre-treatment study groups were similar with no significant difference in scores. Both treatment groups experienced significant improvement in the TNAPSI scores. In the monotherapy group only, one nail showed no improvement, and patient satisfaction score was excellent in 43.3%. In the combo group, 2 nails showed no improvement, and 30% of patients reported excellent satisfaction. When the 2 groups were compared, there was no significant difference between monotherapy and combination therapy. Side effects included a pain level on a visual analog scale of 3.3 and new onset nail pitting in 3 nails from each group. This study confirms findings of similar studies, which have showed that fractional CO2 with various topical treatments can improve nail psoriasis. Interestingly, in this study, the addition of topical betamethasone calcipotriol ointment did not provide any additional improvement, and the authors hypothesize that the topical steroids may antagonize the beneficial tissue remodeling and wound repair process after CO2 laser. Larger studies will be needed to confirm these results and to optimize the protocols for laser-assisted drug delivery for nail psoriasis.
This is Deirdre Hooper reviewing combining proximal foam sclerotherapy and distal intravenous laser ablation for recurrent varicose vein treatment. And this is by Simon Bossart, Sebastian Koss, and lead author Heiko Uthoff out of Switzerland. Intravenous laser ablation is becoming the preferred treatment for truncal vein insufficiency. It has high success rates and low complication rates. But the authors describe a challenge when you have recurrent varicosities after EVLA, namely that you have some tortuous vessels, and those are going to require a combination of 2 treatments, injectable foam sclerotherapy and repeat intravenous laser ablation. So in this retrospective observational study of 26 patients with 28 varicose veins, the authors present a simultaneous foam sclerotherapy intravenous laser ablation therapy with a novel laser fiber. So the design of the fiber, and the photos are nice in the paper, allows you to proximally inject some foam sclerosin, which travels and then is distally injected into the varicosity with simultaneous 1470 nanometer intravenous laser ablation. So in the paper, they describe in good detail the specifics of this procedure, which is a walk-in, walk-out procedure involving tumescent local anesthesia and high-resolution ultrasound guidance. And they point out some advantages with this procedure. Number one, the tumescent anesthesia uses epinephrine, which induces vasoconstriction. Also, tumescent anesthesia externally compresses the veins, so the vein is empty and the sclerosant is more efficacious. Number two, both ultrasound guidance and the avoidance of sharp needle used in injection sclerotherapy
help keep that sclerosant precisely intravascular and avoids AEs. In the study, there were no thromboembolic events, pain scores were low, and satisfaction was high. They were able to follow these patients for up to a year, and they had high satisfaction, although the limitation is, of course, that there was only 1 year of follow-up. So in conclusion, a combination of foam application with simultaneous EVLA and a novel fiber seems to be a safe and effective method to treat recurrent varicose veins.
This is Deirdre Hooper reviewing the original article, a comparison of two hyaluronic acid-based fillers for the treatment of acne scars, structural lifting versus biostimulatory effect, by first author Joseph Mehrabi and lead author Tamir Horovitz. This was a prospective, split-face, double-blind study comparing two hyaluronic acid-based fillers. One is a traditional cross-linked product, Juvederm Voluma, and one is a novel, non-cross-linked product, Profilo, to treat atrophic acne scars. Inclusion criteria were males and females age 18 to 70 with grade 3 to 4 acne scars on the Goodman-Barron scale. There were 30 patients enrolled, and their left and right cheeks were randomized to receive either Juvederm Voluma or Profilo for a total of 60 cheeks injected. The treatments were repeated monthly for 3 months, and then there was a final observational follow-up at 6 months after the third treatment. The technique was cannula subcision followed by depose of HA at the base of each scar for a total of 1 ml per side at each treatment. The results showed a statistically significant volume improvement by month 3 with both products that continued to improve with Profilo but not Voluma. There was additional volume improvement at the 6-month post-third injection mark for Profilo. At the final visit, Profilo also showed superior improvement in elasticity as compared to Juvederm Voluma. The discussion centered on the differing time courses of improvement between the two products used. Juvederm Voluma achieved a more pronounced earlier improvement, but the effects tapered by the fourth visit, which was 6 months after the last injection. Alternatively, the Profilo product was inferior as a structural benefit in the early stages, but demonstrated superiority in later evaluations. They offered one potential explanation based on Profilo's consistency. Profilo is non-cross-linked in a combination of differently sized, low and high molecular weight complexes that has the ability to act as a biostimulatory agent. So differing from traditional cross-linked HA fillers, as Profilo has no cross-linking, cross-linked HA fillers are considered structural but have limited capacity for biostimulatory effect. The limitations of the study are the small sample size and the short follow-up period, and that only one product was used as a comparator to Profilo. In her commentary, Natalia Ribe from Barcelona calls HA fillers with biostimulatory capability a new paradigm for skin restoration and laxity improvement, and points out that the product in this paper has pro collagenogenic and pro-adipogenic effects, and she specifies that Profilo differs from the cross-linked HA gels in three significant ways. Number one, it has a very high concentration of HA at 32 milligrams per ml, which is higher than the products we have currently on the market today. Number two, it has very high fluidity. Its tan delta is greater than 1, which means it is a more viscous than elastic gel. And three, that it is highly biocompatible.
This is Monica Bowen, and I'll be reviewing persistent non-inflammatory nodules are frequently located in the fascia after filler injections by first author Leni Schelke and last author Peter Valthius. One potential adverse event of dermal fillers are nodules, which are either inflammatory or non-inflammatory. The non-inflammatory nodules are theorized to be secondary to injecting too much product superficially or with too much volume in one area. This was a prospective case series from a hospital that manages filler complications, and they evaluated 27 consecutive patients with non-inflammatory nodules via ultrasound. A total of 27 patients were included in this case series. Majority of the nodules, 63%, occurred early, within 4 weeks. and patients presented with visible nodules or regularities in the majority of cases, and 4 patients presented with only pain and no irregularities. Duplex ultrasound was used to evaluate these nodules in all the cases and showed that in all of the cases, the filler material was found between the fibrils of the SMAS. And in 2 patients who had jawline filler, the filler was in the parotid gland. So there are some fantastic figures in the article so that you can learn how to identify the SMAS and fillers on ultrasound. For instance, the SMAS is hyperechoic or white, as is bone, and the filler is hypo or anechoic or black. And so on ultrasound, it is relatively straightforward to identify if there is a little filler blob, because it'll be black on ultrasound, while the surrounding tissue will be various degrees of white. So treatment of the nodules included ultracyte guided injection into the filler deposits of about 50 to 150 units of hyaluronidase, and that did clear the nodules. So in this article, the authors concluded that non-inflammatory nodules may be due to improper injection technique or migration into the fibrils of the SMAS. The authors have a table on pearls on how to prevent nodules and injection to the SMAS, such as making sure you're in the correct subcutaneous layer, and if you're using needle and periosteum, not to do retrograde injections, as that filler can move into the fibrils of the SMAS. This is Monica Bowen, and I'll be reviewing the commentary on the article Persistent Non-Inflammatory Nodules Are Frequently Located in the Fascia After Filler Injection by Hema Sundaram. The author of the commentary agrees that non-inflammatory nodules from dermal fillers may be due to misplacement in the SMAS. A filler could have been misplaced into the fascia during an attempt to inject the superficial fatty layer or deeper over the periosteum. Now, filler trapped in the fascia are subject to forces of the central facial muscle contractions and thus have a tendency to aggregate and form these nodules. The author also points out, though, in clinical practice, it may be difficult to use ultrasound-guided injections, especially with the probes, which are hard to hold and then inject while maintaining a sterile field. So instead, if you'd like to scan the area prior to injection or to remove a nodule, you can do a quick scan prior to injecting to assess the depth of the relevant tissue plans or to find the nodules, and then you can inject the filler or hyaluronidase if you are injecting the nodule.
This is Ardalan Minocheta discussing the manuscript Factors Associated with Musculoskeletal Pain Among Hair Transplant Surgeons, Analyses of Survey Data and Review of the Literature. The premise of this manuscript comes from the fact that the prevalence of work-related musculoskeletal disorders, also known as WRMD, is increasing among all surgical specialties. The authors wanted to specifically look within hair transplant surgeons and see what the prevalence is, and if there are any specific risk factors associated with these musculoskeletal symptoms, and see if there are any measures to mitigate this condition. This was a survey study where they contacted the members of the International Society of Hair Restoration. There was an approximately 11% respondent rate, and 78.5% of the respondents did note that they experienced pain while performing surgery. Specifically, the pain was most severe in the neck, followed by the upper and lower back, and followed by extremities. The number of grafts performed per session of follicular unit extraction was correlated positively with pain severity. And then specifically, female surgeons and those surgeons older than 71 years old were at higher risk. Specifically, they mention that most of the respondents expressed a concern that these WRMDs may limit their career and agreed that there is a need for improved workplace education.
This is Megan McLean reviewing the original investigation, efficacy and safety of 5-fluorouracil tattooing to repigment idiopathic guttate hypomelanosis, a split-body randomized trial by Samir Arbachi and Sergio Henrique Hirata. Idiopathic guttate hypomelanosis is a common skin disorder of progressive, often symmetrical, white macules on the extremities. It can affect up to 87% of individuals over 40. Histopathologic features include decreased melanin pigment, reduced number of melanocytes, and superficial dermal fibrosis. Treatment options include topical medications such as phenol and topical calcineurin inhibitors, and procedures such as cryotherapy, non-ablative fractional laser, and fractional CO2 laser. The authors of this study previously published a case series demonstrating improvement in IGH with tattoo delivery of 5-FU. They sought to further establish the safety and efficacy of this treatment with a randomized controlled trial comparing tattooed 5-FU to tattooed saline for IGH. This split-body, single-blinded trial was conducted at a single center in Brazil from 2016 to 2019. Power calculations from a pilot study suggested a sample size of 26 patients to detect an average reduction of 20% of IGH lesions. To account for possible dropout, investigators recruited 29 patients with IGH symmetrically distributed to upper or lower limbs. Limbs were randomized to treatment options by coin flip. Each limb was photographed prior to and 30 days after treatment. The procedure involved a single physician performing the tattoo delivery with either 5-FU or saline to each randomized limb. The primary outcome was repigmentation of IGH lesions, measured by the change in number of achromic lesions compared to baseline. Two independent dermatologists served as the blinded reviewers. Patient satisfaction was also assessed for each limb at follow-up. 29 patients were enrolled and completed the trial. At baseline, there were no significant difference in the median number of achromic IGH lesions in the limbs. 30 days after treatment, there was a significant decrease in median achromic IGH lesions in both groups, from 32 to 12 in the 5-FU-treated group and 31 to 21 in the saline-treated group. There was significantly more reduction in achromic IGH lesions in the 5-FU group than in the saline-treated group. Overall, patient satisfaction was also higher in the 5-FU group. Side effects were limited to mild pain during the procedure, and two patients in the saline-treated group who experienced transient hyperpigmentation, which resolved within 2 months. The investigation suggests tattoo delivery of 5-FU is more effective than tattoo delivery of saline for repigmentation of idiopathic guttate hypomelanotic lesions. The authors report that due to differences in methodology and study design, it is difficult to compare their results to other reported treatments for IGH. The authors also estimate the maximum 5-FU dose received by a patient in their trial to be 0.77 milligrams, or 1,039 times lower than the maximum recommended dose, suggesting that it's safe when used in this way. The authors also present a summary of the differences between microneedling drug delivery and tattoo drug delivery, and created a video tutorial of the procedure for interested physicians. They acknowledge the short follow-up time as a limitation of their study.
This is Isabella Jones reviewing the Resident Cosmetic Clinic, an institutional review and outcomes analysis of the Loma Linda University experience by Desai and Luke. In this article, the authors aim to assess the volume and variety of resident cosmetic training in the Loma Linda Resident Cosmetic Clinic, compare this data to national ACGME data, and promote better cosmetic training and residency programs. From 2014 to 2019, there were 305 patient encounters in the resident cosmetic clinic, with the most common procedures being neurotoxin and soft tissue augmentation. Compared to national ACGME data, the Loma Linda residents performed more non-ablative skin rejuvenation, IPL, and soft tissue augmentation when compared to other programs across the country. The Loma Linda counts ranked in the 70th percentile or higher compared to national counts throughout the entirety of the study. The authors argue that the Loma Linda residents were not only able to perform a greater number of procedures, but also had exposure to a greater variety of procedures. Current ACGME procedure requirements state that over a 3-year residency, trainees are only required to observe or perform at least 15 laser procedures, 10 botulinum toxin procedures, and 5 soft tissue filler procedures. This is in contrast to the prerequisites for dermatologic surgery, which state that residents are required to independently perform 50 benign or malignant excisions before graduation. The authors argue that a review and modification of ACGME cosmetic procedure requirements may be warranted. They state that another factor contributing to highly variable training environments is the shortage of part-time or full-time academic cosmetic dermatologic faculty, forcing programs to rely solely on adjunct or volunteer faculty, which may limit resident exposure due to malpractice and insurance requirements. In conclusion, this review aimed to highlight an unmet need for greater exposure to and training in a variety of dermatologic cosmetic procedures during residency. In addition, they aim to provide considerations and a framework for achieving optimal learning experiences through the implementation of a resident cosmetic clinic.
This is Dr. Ashley Decker reviewing the communication, intralesional triamcinolone injection of keloid resulting in copious purulence by Drs. L.A. and Carroll. The authors present a case of a 30-year-old female referred to dermatology for a symptomatic periembolical keloid. The patient had a history of keloids in other locations, successfully treated with intralesional Kenalog. On the initial visit, the patient was treated with 0.5 cc's of triamcinolone at a concentration of 40 milligrams per milliliter. At the one-month follow-up, the patient reported drainage from the site. The keloid had decreased in size with a small ulceration at the inferior aspect. No signs of infection were seen. 2 months after the injection, the patient presented with a deep, tender subcutaneous mass underneath the umbilicus. Additional injections were postponed while ultrasound was ordered to help elucidate the etiology. Ultrasound did not reveal a focal abnormality, and the patient underwent another ILK injection. 4 months later, the subcutaneous mass recurred. Again, ultrasound was inconclusive. Excisional biopsy was performed, confirming the diagnosis of a keloid. The diagnosis was made of liquefactive necrosis of the keloid. This is a very unusual complication of ILK injections, and infection should be ruled out prior to making the diagnosis.
I am Curran Lal, and I am presenting remission of a large plantar verruca vulgaris in an immunocompromised patient after incisional punch biopsy by Beatty et al. Out of Ireland. They reported on a 41-year-old man on immunosuppression after human cadaveric renal transplant with a history of a 3.5 centimeter wart on the right heel. This had been recalcitrant to extensive treatment, including topical salicylic acid, 5-fluorouracil, cantharidin, and numerous courses of cryotherapy and pairing over the past 6 years. The wart was treated with 3 incisional 4-millimeter punch biopsies through the center of the wart to the depth of the dermis. The wart was led to heal in situ. The wart had completely cleared at 6 weeks. The mechanism is proposed to be due to enhanced penetration and presentation of viral wart antigens into the circulation. This is a very interesting concept, and it's something I haven't heard of but would be curious to try. Warts can be difficult to treat, and this may be a good option for solitary refractory warts in all patients, including those that are immunosuppressed.
This is Ardalan Menoketa discussing the article Levels of Evidence Within Dermatology, Bibliometric Trends Compared with General Medicine and General Surgery from 2008 to 2017. The authors state, quote, modern evidence-based medicine is driven by the results of high-quality, high-evidence studies, end quote. They define these as systematic reviews, meta-analyses, and randomized controlled trials. They state that despite the adaptation of high evidence guidelines, there is low reporting quality that persists in scientific publications, including dermatology journals. So in this premise, there are limited studies assessing the levels of evidence in dermatology publications. The authors wanted to look at this and see how dermatology compares with other specialties. Bibliometric analyses were used to compare the proportion of these high evidence level studies published within the top 10 journals of dermatology, general medicine, and general surgery from 2008 to 2012 and 2013 to 2017. The study did ultimately show that dermatology had the highest increase in all study types, all those high level of evidence study types within the time intervals, with a statistically significant increase in systematic reviews and meta-analyses. One of the factors that the authors did highlight was that the growth of those systematic reviews in dermatology was so promising, and they did note that there was a relative plateau in randomized controlled trial publications across all specialties. This was disappointing, and the authors recommended that future research should be done to examine the barriers to making randomized controlled trial publications and the rationale for the downward trend.
Welcome to Beyond the Digest, offering bonus content covering surgical articles in dermatologic literature outside the peer-reviewed journal Dermatologic Surgery. Reference the episode description for publication details of the content covered.
This is Yesil Kim, and I'll be reviewing polypoid melanoma is associated with aggressive histopathological characteristics and poor clinical prognosis, a retrospective cohort study by first author Elizabeth Peterson and senior author Allison Durham. Polypoid melanoma is a rare growth pattern of melanoma characterized by a pedunculated exophytic component. Most have a thick basal depth, which likely contributes to their poor prognosis. There is currently no data that indicate if polypoid melanoma should be managed differently than tumors of similar thickness and clinical stage. The authors evaluated the histopathologic features and clinical outcomes of polypoid melanomas from a single institution with a large melanoma referral program. This was a retrospective cohort study of patients with polypoid melanoma treated from 1996 to 2018. Polypoid melanoma was defined as melanoma with an exophytic pedunculated component connected to the skin surface by a stalk. 37 tumors met inclusion criteria. 265 non-polypoid nodular melanomas was the comparison group. The average age at diagnosis was significantly younger for polypoid melanoma, 54.7 years, versus nodular melanoma of 62.6 years. Polypoid melanomas had a greater average basal depth, average was 7.17 millimeters versus 3.56 millimeters in nodular melanomas. Also, it had a greater rate of ulceration and presence of lymphovascular invasion. There were no differences in presence of nodal, in-transit, and distant disease at time of diagnosis, but there was a tendency to have an overall higher AJCC clinical stage for polypoid melanomas. There was a significantly higher incidence of distant metastatic recurrence for patients with polypoid tumors, and polypoid tumors were associated with worse overall survival and decreased disease-specific survival. Multivariable analysis controlling for basal depth and other factors showed that polypoid melanomas was a significant independent risk factor for distant metastatic recurrence, overall survival, and disease-specific survival. Given these findings, polypoid melanoma can be considered a more aggressive pattern of melanoma.
This is Elizabeth Cusick reviewing the research letter, Drivers of Overall Mortality in Merkel Cell Carcinoma, a Population-Based Analysis, by first author Dr. Jeremy Odkoff and senior author Dr. Atan Holzer. This article begins by providing the background that while Merkel cell carcinoma is a rare and highly aggressive cutaneous malignancy, there is limited information on the causes of death among patients with Merkel cell carcinoma. The author's objective in this study was to delineate the causes of death associated with Merkel cell carcinoma and to further investigate the incidence of cardiovascular disease deaths among patients with Merkel cell in order to better identify those patients at greatest risk. Patients who were diagnosed with Merkel cell carcinoma were identified using the Surveillance Epidemiology and End Results Research Database from 1975 to 2016. Of the 9,375 patients identified, the median age at diagnosis was 75 to 79 years. Of the 5,818 patients who died during the median 27-month follow-up, less than half, at 40.4%, were attributable to Merkel cell carcinoma. Other malignancies accounted for 17.4% of deaths, with hematologic malignancies, lung cancer, and melanoma being the most common cause of cancer diagnoses. Interestingly, cardiovascular disease accounted for 19.6% of these deaths. Those who died of cardiovascular disease were a single 5-year age category older at the time of diagnosis than those who died of Merkel cell carcinoma. Male sex was associated with a 2.33% increased risk of death due to cardiovascular disease. Conversely, being married was associated with a 59% risk reduction. Overall, patients with Merkel cell carcinoma were 8.18 times more likely to die of cardiovascular disease. In summary, most patients with Merkel cell carcinoma died from non-Merkel cell carcinoma-related deaths in this prospective study, population study. Cardiovascular disease mortality occurred at a significantly greater rate than in the general population, with single men as those at greatest risk. This observation, along with the high mortality from secondary malignancies, stresses the importance of continuing age-appropriate screening for cardiovascular disease and cancer among patients with Merkel cell carcinoma.
My name is Amy Green, and I will be reviewing the research article entitled Perioperative Imaging for High-Stage Cutaneous Squamous Cell Carcinoma Helps Guide Management in Nearly One-Third of Cases, a single institution retrospective cohort by Dr. Frederick Gibson and senior author Dr. Emily Ruiz out of Brigham and Women's Hospital. The NCCN guidelines currently recommend imaging of cutaneous squamous cell carcinoma when there is concern for extensive disease, such as bone invasion, perineural or deep tissue invasion. The imaging modality and timing is not standardized. Previous studies from the same institution showed that imaging of high-risk tumors changed management in up to a third of cases, and those that received preoperative imaging were more likely to undergo adjuvant therapy and have improved outcomes. So this retrospective analysis was done to evaluate the utility of imaging in a more modern cohort. All cutaneous squamous cell carcinoma diagnoses were examined from June 2013 to March 2020 at Brigham and Women's Hospital. Patients were included if they received imaging preoperatively or within 30 days following treatment. Patient and tumor characteristics were recorded and can be seen in Table 1, so I'll turn you to that. The majority of tumors were AJCC-T3, or Brigham and Women's BWH-T2B, and on the head and neck. The most common imaging modality was a CT scan, and 47% received preoperative imaging, with 15% receiving it same day, and 36% postoperatively within 30 days. 99 T2B, T3 primary tumors from 93 patients underwent imaging within the required time frame. 38% had abnormal imaging results, and management was altered in 30%. Altered management included additional imaging in 23%, addition of adjuvant radiation therapy or systemic therapy in 20%, no longer being a surgical candidate in 13%, or change of the surgical plan in 50%. Of the 99 tumors, 16% had confirmed metastasis on imaging. 5 of the 10 tumors that showed enlarged lymph nodes on imaging were confirmed to have nodal disease on biopsy. So this single institution analysis does suggest that imaging should be considered in high-stage T2B, T3 cutaneous squamous cell carcinomas perioperatively to guide management decisions. Further studies are needed to determine the optimal imaging modality as well as the imaging regimen.
This is Kay Matosko, and I will be reviewing risk of recurrence of nail unit melanoma after functional surgery from the May 2023 JAAD. By first author Byung Ho Oh and last author Ki Yang Chung. As opposed to amputation for nail unit melanoma, these authors have been performing functional surgery on patients with no bone invasion as seen on pre-op MRI. Amputations are performed when the pre-op MRI shows bone invasion or when the margins from the functional surgery were positive. In their procedure, they remove the entire nail unit, including at least 3 to 4 millimeters from the nail plate and matrix, and then down to periosteum. To investigate the incidence of recurrence and distant disease, authors performed this retrospective study of 140 patients with nail unit melanoma and a follow-up period of at least 3 years. 33 patients had amputation and 107 had functional surgery. Breslow thickness in the amputation group was 3.14 millimeters and 0.7 millimeters in the functional surgery group. Recurrence was 30% in the amputation group and 7% in the functional surgery group. Recurrence was found to be associated with male gender, greater Breslow thickness, amelanotic color, ulcers, and nodules. Lastly, they determined 0.8 millimeters to be the optimal cutoff for stratifying risk of recurrence after surgery using the greatest UDIN index and negative predictive value of 88%. This article, along with the more recent studies evaluating Mohs and treating nail unit melanoma, are making a greater case for digit-sparing surgery.
Hi, this is Harrison Nguyen reviewing the article Dermatologists Grow Lead in Cutaneous Reconstructions Over the Last Decade, a cross-sectional analysis of 2009 to 2019 Medicare data by authors Andrea Tan, Nicholas Kastner, and Jordan Slutsky. Multiple studies have demonstrated that the majority of skin cancer destructions, excisions, and Mohs surgeries are performed by dermatologists. This study aimed to provide an update to a prior 2009 study evaluating what proportion of reconstructive surgeries, such as linear repairs, flaps, and grafts, are performed by dermatologists. The authors queried the 2019 Medicare physician and other practitioners' public use files and total volume and percentage of cutaneous reconstructions performed by physician specialty was determined for relevant CPT codes. Here's what they found. In 2019, the dermatologists accounted for 85.4% of all cutaneous reconstructions performed in the Medicare population. Subgroup analyses showed dermatology as a top billing specialty for intermediate repairs, performing 90.5%, complex repairs, performing 91.5%, adjacent tissue transfers, performing 67.4%, and full-thickness skin grafts, performing 78.7%. And dermatology was the second highest for simple repairs and split-thickness skin grafts. Compared with reported data from 2009, the increase in proportion of dermatology claims was statistically significant for every closure type, except for interpolation flaps and split-thickness skin grafts, for which 2009 figures were not available. Overall, dermatologists continue to perform the highest volume of cutaneous reconstructive surgeries in the Medicare population compared with other physician specialties. This study demonstrated a significant increase in the percentage of cutaneous reconstructions performed by dermatologists from 2009 to 2019.
This is Yessel Kuhn, and I'll be reviewing the original investigation permanent section margin concordance after Mohs micrographic surgery with immunohistochemistry for invasive melanoma and melanoma in situ, a retrospective dual center analysis by first author Jade Young and senior author Justin Leitenberger. The authors aimed to compare the concordance between MART 1 frozen sections from Mohs for melanoma versus permanent section pathology of a peripheral margin of skin excised around the final Mohs defect. They performed a dual center retrospective analysis to evaluate the concordance rates between frozen and final permanent margins for MIS and invasive melanomas treated with Mohs at two tertiary academic institutions, Oregon Health and Science University and Cedars-Sinai Medical Center. Mohs was performed with frozen sections stained with MART 1 until all margins were considered clear. Once a margin was determined to be clear, a final 1 to 2 millimeter margin was taken and sent as a permanent section with overnight paraffin fixation and on FOSS margin evaluation by a board-certified dermatopathologist. Margins were considered positive if the permanent sections were noted to have residual melanoma or MIS. It was indeterminate if the final pathology noted increased single melanocytes, atypical melanocytic proliferation, or if residual MIS could not be excluded in permanent sections. And samples were negative if no increased single melanocytes, atypical melanocytic proliferation, or if residual MIS were detected. Then they grouped cases as concordant, indeterminate, or discordant. Across both institutions, 438 patients underwent Mohs for melanoma between 2017 and 2021. 379 of the 438 permanent sections were sent for final pathologic evaluation following the procedure, in addition to the frozen sections performed during the procedure. Of the 379 permanent sections sent, 367 were concordant with frozen section pathology for an overall concordance rate of 96.8%. Of the 12 discordant cases, chi-square analysis demonstrated that there was no significant association between discordance and stage. 5 discordant cases required only one stage, whereas 7 discordant cases required 2 or more stages. All 12 of the discordant cases were of the head and neck. 25% of the discordant cases represented recurrent tumors, whereas 8.4% of concordant tumors were recurrent. There was a significant relationship between discordance and if permanent section was from a recurrent tumor. The authors demonstrate a high concordance between MART1 frozen sections and permanent pathology sent during Mohs. These findings lend credibility to the practice of Mohs for melanoma and validate the accuracy of MART1 and its use in clinical practice. Their findings also suggest that sending additional margins for permanent pathology during Mohs for melanoma has limited clinical utility, as frozen sectioning with immunohistochemistry maintains a high level of accuracy. The 3.2% of permanent sections that were discordant with frozen section pathology generally represented complex cases, with majority requiring multiple stages and all occurring on the head and neck. Limitations include the retrospective design of the study. Furthermore, concordance rate was derived from a comparison of adjacent tissue margins. I do wonder if the results would remain the same if concordance was determined using the same specimen, the final Mohs layer, as frozen section pathology during the procedure and permanent sectioning once thawed and paraffin fixed. In summary, the study showed a high degree of concordance between frozen sections stained with MART1 and permanent margins of the surrounding skin. This disputes the ongoing need for additional permanent margins when using MART1 in routine cases of Mohs for melanoma.
Hi, this is Harrison Nguyen reviewing the article Randomized Study on the Topical Application of Transexamic Acid to the Wound Bed of Granulating Defects for Hemostasis in the Setting of Mohs Micrographic Surgery by authors Brianna Castillo, Anya Anacone, and Nicholas Golda. Postoperative bleeding can be a complication of second intention wound healing. The authors set out to study whether the application of the antifibrinolytic agent transexamic acid could be used as an adjunct to wound care on granulating defects to decrease post-op bleeding. They conducted a double-blind, randomized controlled trial comparing TXA to placebo. The intervention arm received a 25 mg per ml TXA-soaked pad, while the control group received a normal saline-soaked non-adherent pad applied directly to the surgical defect. The non-adherent pad was cut to the size of the defect and soaked in a volume of 1 ml per 1 cm squared of either the placebo or the drug. A petrolatum gauze pressure dressing was applied over top, and patients were instructed to remove the dressing after 48 hours. Patients were given standardized wound care instructions, implying when to apply pressure and when to call with bleeding complications. They were then called on postoperative day 2 to answer yes-no questions about postoperative bleeding and any perceived symptoms related to TXA. A total of 124 patients were enrolled, with 62 patients in each arm. The placebo group had 6 or 9.7% of patients who reported active bleeding within 48 hours after surgery. The TXA group, on the other hand, had no reported bleeding requiring reference to the wound care instructions or even a call to the clinic. The difference was statistically significant, with a p-value of 0.028, and no perceived side effects were reported in either arm. Overall, topical TXA application is an inexpensive and easy addition to wound care in the setting of second intention surgical defects to reduce postoperative bleeding.
My name is Amy Green, and I will be reviewing the research article entitled Predictors of Receipt of Sentinel Lymph Node Biopsy in Patients with Malignant Adnexal Tumors of the Skin by Marina Joel and Dr. Jeffrey Scott out of Johns Hopkins.
Malignant adnexal tumors include rare sebaceous, follicular, apocrine, or eccrine tumors that typically have low metastatic potential and require surgical excision for complete tumor clearance. The authors looked at factors associated with sentinel lymph node biopsy utilization in these tumors. Patients with malignant adnexal tumors were identified using the National Cancer Database from 2004 to 2015. Almost 3,500 patients were identified and 26% underwent sentinel lymph node biopsy, which can be seen in Table 1. Those who received sentinel lymph node biopsy were younger, male, privately insured, living further from the hospital, treated at academic centers, and having a primary site on the trunk and extremities. Conversely, factors negatively associated with sentinel lymph node biopsy included the female sex, Medicare insurance, microcystic adnexal carcinoma histology, or primary site on the lip, eyelid, ear, face, scalp, or neck. The authors hypothesized that decreased utilization of sentinel lymph node biopsy on the head and neck may be due to the complex lymphatic drainage. One limitation to the study is that the analysis did not include sebaceous carcinoma, but overall the study did illuminate some socioeconomic factors as well as patient factors that lead to differences in sentinel lymph node biopsy utilization rates. This does deserve further study with the goal of optimizing clinical decision-making for patients with these rare tumors.
This is Gay Matosko, and I will be reviewing majority of cutaneous squamous cell carcinoma recurrences occur within 3 years after diagnosis, a dual-center retrospective cohort study by first author Fet Su Nguyen and last author Emily Ruiz in JAD May 2023. Authors evaluated 321 SCCs from 296 patients who had poor outcomes defined as either local recurrence, in-transit nodal or distant metastases, or disease-specific death. The median time to local recurrence was 11.3 months. The median time to regional metastasis was 9.7 months. The median time to distant metastasis was 11.9 months. The median time to disease-specific death was 11.3 months. Overall, authors found that 95% of poor outcomes occurred by 3 years, which can be used by dermatologists to guide follow-up for patients diagnosed with cutaneous SCC.
This is Elizabeth Cusick reviewing the original research article, Bacterial Contamination is Involved in the Etiology of Soft Tissue Filler, Late Onset Inflammatory Adverse Events, published in the Plastic and Reconstructive Journal, Surgery Journal by first author Dr. Thomas Decates and senior author Dr. Frank Neeson. As we know, soft tissue fillers are widely used in dermatology, plastic surgery, and aesthetic medicine. In fact, the most recent survey from the American Society of Dermatologic Surgery in 2017 reported an incidence of 21% increase in the number of soft tissue filler injections. With more patients undergoing these injections, adverse events have also increased, and the treatment algorithm in late onset inflammatory adverse events depends primarily on better understanding the etiology of this condition. The objective of this study was to examine whether there is a correlation between adverse events and the presence of bacteria surrounding the injected filler. If so, authors asked the question, could bacterial contamination during the initial injection be the underlying cause of these adverse events? To analyze the microbiota, authors employed a novel and sensitive method using the intergenic spacer profiling, known as ISPRO assay. This PCR technique, based on sequence variations and length of 16S to 23S ribosomal interspacial region, can identify bacteria up to species level and detect bacterial at low quantities. 29 patients were included in this study, 13 of whom experienced late onset inflammatory adverse events, and 16 who did not, which was the reference group. Biopsies were required from both groups. To exclude from contamination skin microbiota, authors compared the microbiota found on skin swabs that they found in corresponding biopsies. Results indicated a high level of gram-positive bacteria were found in biopsies.
of those patients with soft tissue fillers, predominantly in patients with the inflammation group. This suggests the bacteria were introduced during the primary filler injection treatment. The study shows a strong correlation between bacterial load and late onset inflammatory adverse events in soft tissue filler recipients, suggesting a causative role for bacteria, probably by biofilm formation, in the development of late onset inflammatory events to soft tissue fillers.
Thank you for listening to Derm Surgery Digest, the official podcast of the Dermatologic Surgery Journal. To access these featured articles, author videos, and much more, visit journals.lww.com/dermatologicsurgery. To learn more about the American Society for Dermatologic Surgery, visit asds.net.
This is Christy Regula, reviewing well-being and professional fulfillment in Mohs surgeons, an explanatory sequential mixed method design study by first author Charlene Lamb and senior author Tate Schanefelt. Physician well-being is essential to a successful healthcare system. This encompasses both personal and professional aspects of their lives. Professional fulfillment, defined as achieving meaningfulness, self-worth, self-efficacy, and satisfaction at work, is a key determinant of physician well-being. A previous study by the authors from 2021 surveyed Mohs surgeons and found the prevalence of burnout to be 46%. This is a follow-up study to explore factors that drive occupational distress and promote well-being among Mohs surgeons. A pool of 137 respondents from the previous quantitative study were asked to be in this qualitative phase. The first 33 who volunteered were included. These individuals underwent a semi-structured interview that was conducted exploring well-being and burnout. Audio recordings were then transcribed and analyzed to identify common themes. The majority of participants had symptoms of burnout. Themes identified in the analysis include 1, gratitude for the chosen profession. 2, unrealistic standards of perfection that may have contributed to past career success, but are unattainable and create emotional burden. And 3, ability to practice in a manner aligned with personal values, promoting professional fulfillment. Ultimately, the study suggests that gratitude, self-compassion, and the ability to practice in a manner aligned with personal values promote well-being and professional fulfillment in Mohs surgeons. Notably, the study found that unrealistic standards of perfection and personal organization practice incongruencies contribute to burnout.